This is Audible.
I'm Andy McNab, and this is Spoken from the Front. It's no accident that the School of Infantry's badge is a bayonet. It may seem like an outdated form of combat, but it's just as relevant today as it's always been. During the Falklands War in 1982, 18-year-old infantry soldiers charged Argentinian trenches, just as infantrymen did during the First World War. Since the start of the war in Iraq, there has been many instances of British soldiers fixing bayonets after running out of ammo while in contact with the enemy. And that's why bayonet drill is still an important part of every infantryman's training. But the business of killing close up isn't like the movies. Killing Hollywood style is usually quick, easy and very clean, but in real life it's just the opposite. When you're up that close with the enemy, you can actually smell them, even feel their breath on your face. And when you thrust that big lump of steel at the end of your rifle into their body, ramming it in again and again until they're dead, it's the hardest job in the world. So as far as bayonet drill is concerned, there's an army saying that sums it up big time. Train hard, fight easy. Train easy, fight hard and die. This is Andy McNab, Spoken from the Front, and the following story is based on real events.
It was just a routine patrol through Baghdad, out of the protected green zone, then working our way through the residential sprawl towards the Palestine Hotel. We expected it to only take 20 minutes or so, because the two US infantry Humvees we were following never slowed down for anything. That would make them an easier target. They just used their bull bars to ram the back of cars and shove them out of the way if they were driving too slow in front of them. We planned to go up to the hotel roof to check out some potential sniper positions. The two-ship Humvee patrol were four up in each wagon. They planned to stop at the hotel too, so we thought we'd follow along behind for extra protection. We drove along rutted streets clogged with piles of waist-high rubbish. Illegal electricity wires hung overhead in clusters from the single-storey breeze-block houses, and rag-arsed kids threw stones at the cars that bounced along the street. The front 50-cal machine gunner, tucked away in his turret on the Humvee's roof, moved left to right, covering any possible firing positions militants could open up from. And the rear wagon's gunner, she kept her 50-cal always covering the rear. She had a large red-painted sign hanging from the back of the Humvee which told everyone to keep back. If not, she would open fire. They didn't want any suicide bombers today. Our wagon was three up and about 50 metres behind the two-ship. Mark was front left behind the wheel, and Tui in the commander's seat front right. Me, the new boy, I was in the back. I only passed selection 2 weeks ago. Before that, I was a corporal in the Rifles. At last, I was in the SAS, something that I'd been dreaming of since joining the army. Mark was blonde-haired, ex-tank gunner from Manchester, who'd passed selection a year before me. And he was loving not being the new boy anymore. Hey, Tui, I think Jacko here should be the new brew boy, don't you? I think that... Tui, a Fijian, held a massive hand up to stop his waffle. He got on the net. That's Bravo 1 at Blue 8 towards Blue 9. Fijians always talked slowly and calmly. It took a lot to get them sparked up and excited. Junctions in the city were marked by different colours and numbers to identify locations more clearly. Mark was still waiting on his answer as he swerved to the left to avoid a massive pothole. What you reckon, Tui? Time for a new T-boy? Definitely, because yours is crap. Mark and the rest of the troop had been giving me shit since arriving in the zone. But that was a good thing. If they were nice, that was the time to worry. I sat back, checking the safety on the M4 resting across my thighs as the front Humvee crashed into the rear of a Corolla that was crawling along the road. Tui checked his watch. 10 minutes. I think shit for brains in the back there should start by buying the brews at the hotel. Mark liked that idea. Yeah, I think I'll have one of those frothy cappuccinos. I hope we've got some money left because I want to get one of those... Suddenly a truck loaded with bricks pulled out in front of the lead Humvee. Mark hit the brakes. I picked up my M4 with my left hand, ready to power down the window with my right. But before the second wagon even had time to come to a standstill... It was the perfect ambush. Both RPG launchers kicked off at the same time. The back blast of grey-blue smoke spread out from an alleyway between two buildings. As the shaped charges detonated on impact, there were no fireballs, No flying bodies from the two Humvees in front of us. On detonating, the copper lining in the warhead had melted instantly and penetrated both wagons' thin armour. For a second, they were jolted up onto two wheels as the molten metal sprayed out inside the wagons, instantly ripping through all eight of the poor fuckers inside. The wagons fell back onto their four wheels just as the militants, maybe four or five of them, ran out of the alleyway. They opened fire as the front wagon's driver and the rear wagon's 50 cal gunner tried to drag themselves out of the wrecks. Tui was on the net. Contact, contact. Halfway, blue 8, blue 9. The two ships down. Wait out. Mark put his foot down to get level with what was left of the Humvee, as me and Tui got some fire down out of our windows. I kept both eyes open, focusing on the centre mass of a body firing his AK on auto into the Humvees. As he turned towards us, I gave it a short, sharp burst. The body went down and I took aim at another. Mark stopped by the two survivors who had managed to crawl a few metres before their bodies gave up on them. Both were now a mess of blood, pooling on the tarmac. None of the patrol had stood a chance. More AK fire pinged into our wagon as the blocking truck now headed for us. Mark reversed and took the first left turn, trying to get out of the line of fire that was coming from the militants. Fuck! It was a dead end. Tui pushed the door open as our wagon started to take incoming through the rear window.
Get out! Stand your ground!
More rounds bounced off the tarmac and into the wagon as we bailed out. We needed to spread out to survive. Tui called for Apache support as I ran to cover behind a wall. The three of us took up fire positions and brassed up anything that fired or moved towards us and waited. It was all we could do. And then my M4 stopped.
Stoppage!
I dropped down behind the wall and into the dust as I tilted the weapon left to check the ejection port. More AK rounds thudded into the bricks and stonework that protected me. The shock waves ramming against my back as the rounds buried themselves into the meter-thick wall. Fuck, fuck, fuck! I could hear the usual traffic noises 50 metres ahead up at the junction, as if fuck all was happening. It was like we were in our own little time capsule down here. Between bursts from us and the militants, I could hear birds in the trees further up the street chirping happily away. To my right, Mark gave a five-round burst from behind a pile of rubble the other side of what was left of our Land Cruiser. The militants were now in the waste ground across the street, no more than 50 away and closing in. I could feel the skin-scorching heat from my barrel against my face as I checked inside the ejection port. No rounds in the magazine, no rounds in the chamber. But just like this, Meg, my other seven were also empty. They lay in the dust around my feet. Sometimes you just have to accept that you're in it, shit deep. Another AK burst buried itself into the wall as the weapons report echoed off the houses and down the street. Suddenly, all fire stopped from our side of the road. I wasn't the only one who'd run out of ammo. Where was that fucking Apache? I looked across at Mark. He pulled out his bayonet from his chest harness and pushed the upright blade towards me. It was the field signal to fix bayonets. It was the only weapon we had left. Reaching for my harness on my left side, I found the bayonet handle. The blade came out from its scabbard with a metallic grinding noise as the internal sharpener gave the blade a final once-over. I could hear the militants shouting to each other less than 20 metres away now. Mark fixed the lump of steel onto the end of his weapon. I pushed the bayonet handle over my weapon's muzzle and rammed it home with my grime-covered hand, testing to make sure that it was fixed. And suddenly the AK fire stopped. They were coming to check that we were all dead. This was the first time I was ever going to use one of these fucking things in real life. Was I going to be able to kill close up? Shit. In training all those years ago, I'd been running at sandbags, but they didn't fire back at me. Fuck it. Why was I doubting myself? I'd been a soldier for 9 years. It was just another way of killing. Get a fucking grip. I took a breath, and my dry throat made it painful. The only chance we had of living was going forwards and taking the fuckers on. We were dead as of now, so anything that we did was a bonus. Tui was talking to us, keeping his voice low so that they couldn't hear. We're going to go for it. When we make it past them, go right after the waste ground. Check those things are on tight. Stand by, on me. His soft voice always seemed to slow things down, making the situation less of a gang fuck. He nodded at me and Mark before giving his bayonet one last check. I got to my feet, shaking my head as I did so to get the sweat out of my eyes. There were maybe 10 bodies moving across the road towards us, weapons on their hips, looking scarily confident. They'd killed us. And now it was time to get their cameras out and empty our pockets. Fuck. I checked the bayonet was secure once more, waiting for Tui's signal. And just for an instant, my thoughts turned to Holly. I couldn't help it. The last time I saw her was about 2 months ago. It was her second birthday, and she was toddling around the room, finding her feet, and I just had to get out of this shit if I was ever going to see her again. They were now less than 5 metres away. I could smell the cigarette smoke as two of them lit up. I held my breath and I prayed for the sound of Apache rotors. I held the weapon hard with both hands in a semi-squat, bayonet close to my face, waiting for the order. It felt like hours, but it could only have been a second or two before Tui raced past me, weapon up, bayonet pointing forwards. He was screaming at the top of his voice like a madman, eyes fixed, zoned to kill. I followed. No time to think, just do. The massive bodies a few metres ahead looked blurred, but I could see that they were moving and I saw that their weapons were going up. My eyes focused on the nearest target, ignoring everything else around me. I kept my eyes fixed directly on his chest, the centre mass. Everything else was just a blur. It was just him and me now, in our own little world. He looked about my age, thick beard and jeans. I gripped my weapon tightly, squeezing the butt under my arm, trying to keep it still. He was only 5 paces away. I could hear frenzied shouts all around me, but I didn't give a shit. I launched myself towards him. I saw his eyes narrow as he realised what was about to happen. I kept running forward as the blade made contact with his chest. I didn't stop, I just kept going as if he wasn't there. My arms jerked back, as first his jacket and then his skin resisted a little. And then finally the blade rammed home and broke my stride. I could smell his nicotine breath against my face as his eyes lost control of their movement, jerking about all over the place. He started to fall. I pulled back my weapon, but it wouldn't move. Shit. I tried twisting the blade, but it wouldn't come out as he went down. I had to bend with him as my M4 went down, still in his chest. I needed my weapon. It must have got jammed between two of his ribs. His arms and legs were kicking about and his body bucked wildly like he'd been electrocuted. A mix of blood and saliva slapped against my face as he screamed up at me, begging for his life. I twisted the blade around again and again against his ribs. One last high-pitched scream piercing my eardrums as I jammed my left foot onto his chest and twisted the blade and kept pulling. Suddenly, I heard automatic fire coming from close behind me. I turned my head to my left as my weapon jerked free and I saw that Mark was down. He was lying on his back with one leg covered in blood and sticking out at a weird, unnatural angle. There was nothing we could do for him just yet. Killing them before they killed us was all that mattered. I was now on auto mode. There was a blur, a body charging straight for me. I kept my head still and focused my eyes on his long beard. It felt like slow motion as I swung my body round to the left, lifting my weapon up to shoulder level in a sweeping motion as he came level with me. My blade buried into his neck. I let go of my weapon and went down for his loaded AK. The blade stayed in his neck as he dropped to the ground. I grabbed the AK and pushed the firing lever all the way down to single shot. I needed to save ammo. I leapt back up to my feet and stood there firing at anything that moved or stood still. I could hear Tui doing the same. Shit. Dead man's click. Out of ammo. Dropping the weapon, not bothering to look for what else might be going on around me, I focused all of my attention on Mark. I grabbed him and I somehow loaded him over my shoulders. Fuck the gunshot wound. We could sort that out once we were safe. I started to run across the waste ground as more AK rounds kicked off around me. I didn't know if they were Tui's or the militants. It didn't matter. Getting Mark out of the killing ground did. His damaged leg was bouncing against my body and I could feel his warm blood soaking into my shirt as he took the pain. I got past the waste ground and onto a narrow tarmac road. I turned right and I stopped to check behind me while I took a few quick gulps of air. I desperately needed to reoxygenate my lungs after carrying this fucking weight. Tui was running across the waste ground. He was about halfway over when 4 more of the fuckers appeared from the dead end. Shit! No! And then it happened. Best sound I have ever heard. I fell down on my knees to take cover in a doorway, setting Mark down beside me. He was smiling through the pain as the 30mm cannon opened up with its rapid chain gun action. The area around the Land Cruiser became a sandstorm as the rounds pounded down, almost lifting the wagon off the ground as lumps of steel and body parts were propelled into the air by the high explosive rounds. Empty cases from the heli fell down onto the tarmac around us like metallic rain. Finally, I looked down at Mark. New boy, my arse. It's you who's going to be buying the fucking cappuccinos.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme. This is Audible.
I'm Andy McNab, and this is Spoken from the Front. Across the two Gulf Wars, literally thousands of men and women have been kidnapped in Iraq. On average, there are 35 kidnaps a week. The criminal gangs don't care who they take. It makes no difference to them, as long as the hostage can be ransomed for money. That's all that matters. Sometimes the ransom is paid, but more often than not, the ransom money doesn't get paid quickly enough, or things just go wrong. The hostage doesn't get killed, they get sold on to a militant group instead, particularly if the hostage is a Westerner. Unfortunately, the militant groups aren't interested in ransom money. Far more value to them is to have their hostage paraded in front of the cameras, tortured and then executed, all in the name of their cause. Such is the entertainment value of this ordeal, it is possible to buy DVDs of the execution on any Iraqi street market, within hours of the execution taking place. But it isn't just insurgents who use hostage taking as propaganda. The US and UK governments do it too. By condemning the outrage in the media, whether the outcome is good or bad, governments gain support from the British and American people, something they're always looking to do whenever they can. Here are some examples of kidnaps that have gone very wrong. Ken Bigley, a 62-year-old civil engineer from Liverpool, beheaded online with a bread knife. Margaret Hassan, a 59-year-old aid worker who had dedicated her life to helping Iraqis, shot in the head, then the video of her execution was released to the media. There are also, of course, success stories. Norman Kemba, a British peace activist who was rescued by the SAS. Special forces have carried out many successful hostage rescues, and I, for one, am very proud of their skill and bravery. I'm Andy McNab, and this is Spoken from the Front. And the story that follows would no doubt be one of the toughest rescues special forces have had to do yet.
We crashed out of the green zone 15 minutes earlier on this fastball with fuck all information. Tui was in the front right passenger seat, bent over a small monitor in the footwell. It gave out a gentle glow as he watched the ongoing situation, trying to work out the emergency response plan. A Predator UAV, the world's biggest remote-controlled aeroplane, was orbiting the city 50,000 feet above us, completely out of sight and packed with cameras and Hellfire missiles to fuck up someone's day. It was sending a constant feed of the target from his thermal imaging camera, and that was the only information we had. It was only 35 minutes since the informer had told the Americans where Yankee 1, the hostage, was. Even then, we didn't know exactly where in the city he was being held, only that it was being splashed by Predator. Our job? To follow the splash and get Yankee 1 back as quickly and covertly as possible to the Green Zone. And this was one job that we could not fail. Why? Because Yankee 1 was otherwise known as HRH Prince Harry. It was 4 days since he'd been lifted while out on patrol with the Blues and Royals. They'd been hit big time with RPGs on the Iraq-Iran border. His crew all killed, him taken hostage. And they'd been big shit on ever since. How the fuck he had got lifted, being the world's most protected squaddie, will no doubt be covered up for years to come. They'd probably do the usual, bin a couple of generals just for show. Always a good thing, if you ask me. It should have been easy to find him, too. Yankee 1 had a tracking device embedded in his skin between the dermis and the epidermis on his shoulder. But they'd dug it out of his arm within hours of him getting lifted. So much for new technology. I drove as fast as I could, speeding up on the straight bits and then braking to avoid the debris that lay everywhere. Bits of wood, burnt out cars, makeshift barricades that militants had put up. There was even a burnt out Humvee that had been RPG'd 2 weeks before, still sitting there. Amongst the mess, I could still see a thin white beam of IR light, marking a spot maybe 2 km away. I kept heading straight for it. The four assault groups all had M4 rifles, with SIGs as secondary weapons. Both strapped to our legs with the two magazines on the opposite leg.
We weren't doing this to look war-y. It was just that with the new Osprey body armour, it was practically impossible to draw your weapon from your hip because you were dressed up like Robocop. Two massive plates either side of your Kevlar vest and a big Kevlar collar that protected you from upblasts. You even got special bat wings, two huge Kevlar sleeves that came down to your elbow. So we sat back from the monitor. Jacko, how far we got? I checked the beam ahead. About K. So we looked back at Kenny and Dan. Time to turn their shot off. That's Bravo 1 at Green 5. The green spots on the map belong to Sado City, one of the nine districts of Baghdad. It was called Badlands by the Americans. Hundreds of soldiers had been shot, blown up, hit with rockets and firebombed here over these past 4 years. None of us came into this part of town unless we had enough heli and tank support to flatten the whole district if the shit hit the fan. But tonight was different. Dan, Kenny and me had watched the Harry Online video that was released by the militants. He was in shit state. Naked, cut up, big swollen face with half his teeth missing, and a big chunk of flesh gouged out of his left arm where the tracking device had been. Those looks weren't going to get him on the front page of Hello this week, that's for sure. You couldn't really hear what he was saying, but he was talking, and that meant he was breathing. That was the main thing. As for Harry being over here, well, I thought much the same as the rest of the troop. Of course we'd taken a piss out of him about coming over here in his little tank to save us all. But he's a soldier, and soldiers are paid to fight. He should be here, and I'd be pissed off if he wasn't. I didn't give a shit if he was third in line to the throne or an 18-year-old private from a Manchester housing estate. He was one of us. He was here fighting, and now he was in the shit. We'd all watched as Harry refused to denounce the Britain-American presence in Iraq. He then got a rifle butt slammed into his face and disappeared off the screen as he went down screaming. You could see him pushing him into a wooden trunk, jumping on his legs to get all of him inside.
Bet Granny's gonna be pissed off. I hope every man and his fucking dog is out looking for me when I'm lifted. It'll be worth you getting lifted if you get some of that.
Kenny and Dan were both in their late 20s. They were both Scousers, they had the same curly brown hair, and they'd been Scalies, Royal Signals, at the same time. As far as I could tell, the only difference between them was that Kenny had acne scars pitted all over his face. He looked like the surface of the moon. But since he was a big fucker, nobody took the piss. These two were joined at the hip. They'd even married twin sisters in Hereford. Tui got on the net. All call signs, this is Bravo 1. Listen in. Yankee 1 is somewhere in a two-story burned-out building. Can't see any sign of life in or around the target. If we get to it without getting pinged, I want Bravo 2 to make entry on red. I see windows. Acknowledge. Colours give us the sides of the building. White is front, black is back, red is right, and green is on the left-hand side. Bravo 3, make entry on green. You have windows, acknowledge. Roger that. Bravo 4, on black. Secure the outside and the wagons. You have a door there, acknowledge. Roger that. Bravo 1, I'll take white. Remember what we're here for. Yankee 1, I want him in a wagon as soon as... Then once we're all complete, I'll give the word to move. We hadn't a clue what we were up against. The doors or windows could be barricaded or booby-trapped. The militants could be wearing body armour or just string vests. They could be ready for us, or they could be as high as kites on heroin from Iran. Having three assault groups making entry at three different points at least gave us a 1 in 3 chance of actually getting in the building and finding the little fucker. Plus, if we all managed to make entry, we could swamp the place before whoever had lifted Yankee 1 had time to react and kill him. If we get to our entry point, I want...
Wait
out. I couldn't see what was on the monitor, but the job had gone noisy for sure. They had to know we were coming. Tui gripped my arm, calm and slow as always.
Stop.
Go to white light. Kenny was already out of the wagon ripping off the IR film. The other three wagons were doing the same. We started to light up the whole street. Looking down at the monitor, I could see five solid white bodies moving about on the roof, giving off lots of thermal. One of them was about half the size of the others, maybe a boy. He was following two men who were dragging a large box, and the fuzzy shape giving off heat inside it was easily recognisable as a body. Dan hit my shoulder.
At least we know the twat's there, don't we?
I ripped off my NVGs and Tui took them as Kenny shut his door. Let's go. I'll guide. Dan, give a commentary.
All call signs, this is Bravo 1. Yankee 1 on the roof in his box. We got 5 x-rays and 4 of them with longs. The other's a boy, he's got a fucking sword. A camera's been rigged up. The little shit's now standing in front of it. Yankee 1's getting dragged out the box. It's getting scary.
Keep straight, not far now. Kenny checked the mag on his M4.
Oh, that's it then, they're gonna have his head. Get your fucking foot down, Jacko lad, or they'll be playing football with it soon.
Give me the net. All call signs. We're approaching on black. Approaching on black. Change of plan. Bravo 1 is going to make entry on black. Here we go. Out. Tui picked up his M4 and checked the magazine was on tight as Kenny pulled out the door charge from the day sack at his feet.
Contact. Contact.
Muzzle flashes came off the target's roof. I just kept going until I was about 20 short and then I hit the brakes. The rest of the team threw open the doors and bomb burst out. Bravo 4 was already putting down covering fire from behind us. I wriggled myself out from behind the steering wheel, grabbed my M4 and I followed. I ran behind the other three, pulling out the collapsible butt of my M4. Fuck the firing above, it didn't matter. No tactics or finesse, just get to the door, blow it in and make entry. The other two entry teams were running to the left and right of us, heading for red and green. Rounds bounced off the concrete around us, making a whizzing noise as they ricocheted back into the air. Kenny reached the door first and banged on 2 door charges. One on the first hinge, a third of the way up, and the other on the second hinge, a third of the way down. As I reached the door, Tui was pulling out a flashbang and pushed me next to the door frame. That made me the first one through the door. Tui thrust the flashbang in front of my face to show me he was ready to back me. Concrete dust was falling down on us as the rounds from Bravo 4 kept all heads down on the roof. After I joined the troop, it had took me a while to work out that it was okay to be scared. Everyone is. Being scared is good. It makes you stop, think, and take action to keep yourself alive. It is fear that makes you leave your cover and run towards the enemy. It's fear that makes you run into a dark room not knowing what's in there waiting for you. Only then the training takes over and you get on with the job. We practice these assaults time and time again. The motto of the SAS shouldn't be who dares wins, but check and test. Check and test. I got the weapon into my shoulder, pulled the butt in there tight, safety catch on first click, single shot. One quick press on the torch button to check that everything was ready as Kenny pushed himself against the wall on the other side of the door frame.
Stand by.
The shockwave shuddered through my body as if I'd been slammed against the wall. But I'd no time to recover. Tui threw the flashbang into the building and I followed in. Both eyes open, finger pad on the trigger, butt in the shoulder, torch on, penetrating the darkness. I could feel the concrete dust from the detonation filling my nostrils as the flashbang sent shockwaves around the room. Groping my way to the stairs, I began to move up them, the rest of the team behind me, weapon now pointing up, mouth open, trying to get more air in. There was an explosion on red. I ignored the flashbang that followed and put all my focus on getting up those stairs, using my torchlight to make my way through all the dust and flashbang smoke filling the air. There were shouts from above and then some muzzle flash. We started to take fire. There was no thinking. I kept moving up, double tapping the weapon towards the flash, always moving forward, always double tapping, making ground towards the roof. There were more screams and firing from above. And then entry was made on green. I kept double tapping, both eyes still focused on the muzzle flash. That's all I could see. My ears ringing with a high-pitched whine after the flashbangs and high-velocity rounds. A body fell down the stairs right in front of me, his AK following. I scrambled over him, heading for the gap above. I could see the stars. On the roof, the X-rays were moving around, their weapons all firing towards our wagons below. One of them turned, long beard, black jacket, and started kicking off a long burst towards me. I stopped, focused on his head, then double-tapped as Tui came up to my left and started firing too. Two more X-rays turned towards us, firing back in a wild frenzy. Tui went down. Fuck! I jumped over him to take aim on the shits as Kenny and Dan got onto the roof and joined in the firefight.
We'll hold it! The Yankee! Get the fucking Yankee!
I turned to see Yankee 1 on his knees.
The boy, no more than 12 years old, standing in front of him. His young eyes were manic and spit flew from his mouth as he cursed down at Yankee One, oblivious to what was going on around him.
I held my breath to keep my body as still as possible. I needed a stable platform for the weapon. This wasn't one to fuck up. I closed my left eye. The boy was maybe 8 meters away. He started to raise the sword with both hands. Yankee One's head was down, accepting death. I focused on the boy's shaved head. My foresight was clear and sharp on the center of his skull. The target was fuzzy. The sight picture was perfect. The boy dropped like liquid. The back of his head was still splattering into the air as he fell on top of Yankee One. Both of them went down. The X-rays were dead and blooding out over the roof. Kenny was firing down onto White from the edge of the roof. More were moving in. Dan was running to join Kenny.
Get him! Get the fucker out!
Pulling the boy off Yankee One, I saw a naked and blood-covered mess. He was tied with his hands behind him and attached to his ankles. His eyes were closed. I pulled out my bayonet and started to cut him free.
Get up! Come on! Let's go!
There was shit on getting downstairs now. We needed to get out of here. He wasn't moving. I kicked him, trying to spark the fucker up.
Get up!
He looked up at me. I couldn't recognize his face. It was so beaten. But I could hear words rasping through a bloody mouth. I can't. My legs, they won't move. It'd been too long in that fucking trunk. I started to drag him towards the roof's doorway, his body unfolding as I pulled.
This is Bravo One. Fire mission over.
I turned to see Tui looking over at White, his pistol drawn. His weapon was in shit state and his face covered with blood. Thank fuck for that. I dragged Yankee One to the door by his wrists, his arse dragging the X-ray's blood from the roof with us.
All call signs were coming down. We are coming down.
My M4 bounced on my side on its sling as I staggered under the dead weight, almost carrying him down the stairs. I got down to the ground floor, got out on Black, and dragged him towards the wagon as the first hellfire kicked off above us. The sky lit up for a nanosecond like sheet lightning just before the explosion as I threw Yankee One into the back of our wagon. All call signs were withdrawing now, running past me into their wagons. I jumped into the driver's seat and slammed the door, ready to go. Another burst came out of the darkness towards us at ground level from an alleyway, and Bravo 4 brassed up the muzzle flash with a full mag each as my crew got back into the wagon. I hit the gas and started to turn the wagon around. The lights from the other wagon shone into the cab as it turned. I looked over at Tui's Osprey. He'd taken two rounds into his front plate, and his M4 had taken a round into the stock. The shattered plastic had shot up into his face. Not a pretty sight. Yankee One was between Dan and Kenny, and Dan was trying to get him to talk to make sure he was breathing.
Oi! You're leaking all over the fucking place! Come on, lad! Speak up!
Another hellfire kicked off behind us as Kenny grabbed hold of Yankee One's jaw and pulled his head towards him.
For you, Harry, Zavod is over.
We all started pissing ourselves, and I think even Yankee One managed to smile.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program. This is Audible.
I'm Andy McNab, and this is Spoken from the Front. IEDs, improvised explosive devices, have always been a major fear for the British Army. Even during my operational tours of Northern Ireland, I was blown up three times by devices that were laid by the Provisional IRA. These were crude bombs, made from fertiliser and diesel fuel oil. But today, IEDs are far more sophisticated, even using mobile phone technology to detonate high explosive. These devices are then concealed on the side of the road, or even under it, hidden in drainage culverts. Unfortunately, the tactic of simply blowing up soldiers works. In Iraq, more British and US troops have been killed by IEDs than there have by gunshot wounds. But fortunately, combat medicine is now so advanced, more soldiers survive these attacks than ever before. I'm Andy McNab, and this is Spoken from the Front. The following story is based on real events.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places.
We were crunching through the streets of Baghdad in the Warrior, heading for the British Embassy. The Warrior is the infantry's fighting vehicle, basically 25 tons of dead hard steel. Kenny, Dan and I were in the back, sitting in the red glow of our night viewing lights. Above us, through the open mortar hatches, we could see streetlights and the ruins of what had once been city buildings looming down from each side of the road. The two wagons escorting us from the green zone belonged to the infantry rifle company that was protecting the British Embassy not far from our compound. Tui was getting his face sorted out after the Prince Harry job, so tonight it was just the three of us from the regiment. We were hitching a ride to a drinks party. Seriously. That stuff really does go on even in the middle of a war zone. After all, there are certain standards that have to be kept up. Of course, we wouldn't normally get a look in, but we'd been invited as a thank you for getting HRH out of the ship. The inside of the wagon was as dust-covered as the city outside. I was at the front of the passenger section, the commander's scabbed-up boots dangling by my head from the turret above. Kenny and Dan were sitting on the benches with me, facing each other by the rear door, and they were sharing that fucking iPod again. Johnny, the wagon's top cover, was standing up between the three of us. His top half, protected by his Osprey body armour and helmet, was sticking out through the mortar hatch as he covered the rear with his mini-me machine gun. Dan had to shout above the noise of both the tank tracks and his iPod. He found a way of plugging into the wagon's speaker system. He pointed at my shirt.
You could have dressed up for the occasion, soft lad. That shirt's in shit state.
Well, at least I didn't come in a floral one. There's no way you're going to score with the ambassador's wife with that on. Dan looked down at his brightly coloured shirt and grinned.
Oh, she'll love it. Besides, I've got some of those fucking Ferrero Rocher chockies with me. I can't fail.
I pulled back on the tubey grip on my left forearm, checking that my catheter was still in place. We'd all inserted one in a vein before we left the green zone, along with the anticoagulant we put in the catheter to stop the blood from clotting. We'd all be good for the next 24 hours. If you get brassed up on a job, it's hard to get a vein up, particularly if you've lost a lot of blood and you're in the dark and under fire. So everyone sticks one in. We all had to be ready, because for the next 24 hours, we were the standby team. Anything that Special Forces had to deal with was ours. That's why we'd been allowed to go to the reception to have a few sherbets. We'd nothing else to do except hang about waiting for something to happen. Kenny and Dan were arguing about what track to have on next. Kenny grabbed the iPod.
I don't want that one. It's shite.
Oh, don't be such a twat. That's the best track on it.
I wish Tui was here with us. At least I'd have someone semi-normal to talk to. I rested my head against the steel frame of the wagon and let them get on with it, thinking about what I was going to do during my R&R in 3 weeks' time. I'd not seen Holly since she'd started to walk, and now she was toddling around getting her fingers into everything. Thinking about her made me think of the future, of my life after the regiment. I was a month into my business law degree. It'd take a few years, but it'd be worth it. My army career was going to end when I was 40, if I liked it or not, so there was a whole new life ahead of me to plan for. A couple of the lads from the squadron had already got their degrees, so why not me?
Move. I didn't want to, just in case there was a part of me not working. Or even worse, missing. The wagon was now resting on its side. The mortar hatch opened to the ground instead of the sky. I forced myself to move my toes. They were all there. And then my fingers. All moving. I still had limbs. Alive and in one piece. Thank fuck for that. Anybody alive? Speak to me! Being in the middle must have saved me. The rear of the wagon took the hit. I saw movement towards the back, but there was so much smoke it was hard to see who it was. I could just make out the bodies mangled on top of each other. I forced myself off my back and I scrambled towards the rear. Show me movement! Is there anyone alive? No answer. I felt warm liquid run down my back. Blood was pouring down from the turret. I turned to see the two bodies slumped and still. They'd taken the upblast. Johnny's headless body now lay crumpled against the side of the wagon. The rest of his top half held in place by the Osprey. I groped my way over what was left of him to get to the other two. Kenny was lying over Dan. There was blood everywhere, but no obvious holes in his body. Kenny! Kenny, get up! I tried to shake him. I tried to drag him off Dan, but he wasn't moving. The other warrior was outside covering us now, trying to prevent the insurgents moving in to kill any survivors before the crash-out teams arrived. Our attackers would be out there, hiding in the dark. They would have been watching us drive over the IED, ready to detonate it at exactly the right time. It could have been set off by radio control or by a wire attached to the detonator and then running from the device to their hide. You touch the wires to battery terminals and off it goes. Or they could have used a mobile phone attached to the detonator, pressing quick dial as we moved over the HE, that's high explosive device. They would have used any ordnance, any crap that they could lay their hands on. Mortar rounds, artillery shells, anything with HE in it. I shifted so that I could get a look at Dan underneath Kenny. The smoke was beginning to clear, and I could see his face screwed up in pain. He was moving. I dragged Kenny off him and pulled him out through the mortar hatch onto the churned-up tarmac. He still wasn't making a sound. And there was no sign of entry or exit wounds on him, just gashes. I felt for a pulse in his neck. Found it. And he was breathing. I could just feel it on my hand. He'd been fucked up, but he was still doing the two things that would keep him alive. Pulling him onto his front so that his tongue wouldn't fall back and choke him, I headed back into the wagon. Dan? Dan? He was much worse. There was blood everywhere. There was a massive leg wound. It looked like someone had cut into him with a butcher's knife and just kept on digging. You gotta help me get you out of here, mate. You gotta give me your hand. Give it to me. You gotta help me. I started to pull as hard as I could to get him out of the wagon and next to Kenny. I needed to be able to see his injury. Inside, it was just too confined. We might get shot out there, but inside the wagon, I wouldn't be able to help him. I dragged Dan by his arms and eventually I squeezed him out of the mortar hatch. Listen, you're all right now, mate. But every man and his fucking dog's gonna be here soon, so just get a grip of that pain. Blood covered his face and matted his hair. He nodded. He knew the score. He knew there was fuck all he could do but just let me get on with it. All the guys in the regiment get trained to deal with trauma wounds and other battlefield casualties. We had to be able to look after one another on jobs where there weren't going to be any backup. It was up to us to keep each other alive. I looked down at Dan's right thigh and the exposed muscle mass. Blood was oozing out onto the mud and the tarmac beneath him. It was only then that I heard the ominous slurping noise coming from the top of his armour. It came in time with his breathing. Shit. This was a lot more worrying than his leg. I ripped the Velcro from the shoulder pieces of his body armour and the two halves came apart to expose his chest wound. His party shirt was soaked in blood. There was an entry wound about the size of a 50p piece in the top of his chest. Something had gone in at an angle just above the top of his armour and penetrated down into his chest cavity. Probably a bit of sheared off metal from the wagon or even some of Johnny's skull turned into a high-velocity round as it shattered in the pressure wave of the detonation. It was definitely a sucking wound. Every time Dan inhaled, I could hear his breath get sucked in through the hole in his chest instead of his mouth, which meant that he wasn't getting any oxygen. It was just going straight into his chest cavity.
We would need to get that sorted out very quickly. Otherwise, the fucker was history.
Oi, listen to me, fuckhead. You've got a sucking wound. You're gonna have to plug it up, all right? Plug it up.
Being nice and comforting. It doesn't work like that when you're out in the field. I got hold of his hand and jammed his palm onto the wound. He wasn't completely out of it. He understood what he needed to do. He was just going to have to fight to keep conscious and make sure that he did his job.
Not long now, mate. The medevac won't be long.
His chest was now airtight, and hopefully normal breathing would resume and his lungs would inflate. I could see the pain in his eyes as he spluttered and coughed. He tried to look down at his leg.
What's it like? What's it like? Shit state, I'll be back. Keep the hole covered.
I scrambled into the back, pulling out the blood-soaked medibag that was behind the commander's seat. There was nothing I could do about the incoming. I just needed to concentrate on Dan and Kenny. Nothing else mattered. I dragged out the field dressings, great big sanitary towels with bandages attached and safety pins to hold them in place. Dan was losing blood fast. I tried to open one of the dressings, but my blood-soaked hands kept slipping on the foil wrapper. I gripped my teeth around it and ripped it open, spitting away the iron taste of Dan's blood before shoving the dressing deep into his wound. The downside of Dan being able to breathe properly was that now he wouldn't shut up.
What's it like? What's it like?
I looked down at him as I pushed the next dressing deep into his leg wound. He screamed, his dust-covered face twisted with the pain.
I told you, mate, it's shit state. Now shut the fuck up.
You never let a casualty see you looking concerned. I screwed two more dressings into the gaping mass of meat that was his leg. He had a lot to scream about. It's no good just piling bandages on top, because the muscle underneath is still going to bleed. Cavity packing, applying direct pressure inside the wound, that's what stops bleeding. I lifted his hand off the chest wound for a minute and rammed one of the foil wrappers over the hole. That would give the wound a better seal. I pushed his hand back down on top of it. Keep the fucking thing there. First you plug the leaks up, then you replace the blood that's been lost. You get that right and the rest can be taken care of by the crash team. Dan's breathing was rapid and shallow, which wasn't good. I felt the pulse on his neck. His heart was working overtime to circulate what little fluid he had left around his body. Most of it had leaked out over Baghdad. I looked round at Kenny. He fucking moved. He'd rolled over onto his back.
Shit!
I grabbed a pack of safety pins and I scrambled over to him. Then I pushed a pin through his lower lip and tongue and I did it up before pulling him back onto his front. That would stop his tongue going back into his throat and fucking things up. He couldn't feel it. He was out. When he did feel it, he would soon react and take the fucking thing out. He still had a pulse. He was still breathing. That was all that mattered for now. Dan was getting worse. I could hear his breathing quicken as I pulled out the plasma expander from the bag. It was a clear plastic container shaped like a washing up liquid bottle. I ripped it out of its wrapper and I bit off the cap. Fuck hygiene. Infections can be sorted out later.
Medivac's coming, mate. Not long.
I pulled out the tube that was going to feed the fluid into him and I let it run down and splash onto Dan's face.
They're nearly here, mate. You keep plugging that hole.
I screwed the tube onto his catheter and started squeezing the bottle to push fluid into his veins to replace the lost blood. Suddenly, Dan's hand fell from his chest and there was a sound like a rush of air escaping. The foil wrapper flew into the air on top of a geyser of blood. It sprayed in all directions, covering my face. Fuck! His lung must have been pierced by whatever had gone in. Pressure had built up in his chest cavity and was released when Dan's hand fell. The strain on his heart was going to kill him. The gush subsided as the pressure released and I put his hand back onto it. It had to stay covered or he wouldn't be able to breathe at all and the pressure would just have to be managed.
Shove your thumb in. I'll release the pressure. You just keep it plugged.
Dan took the pain as he pushed his thumb all the way into the wound.
Crash out here, mate. Thank fuck for that.
The medevac's downblast battered sand and lumps of tarmac into us as it landed on the other side of the crater. There were more tracked vehicles in the distance, their searchlights cutting into the darkness. I could just make out guys running from the aircraft with stretchers. They'd got all the gear and really knew what they were doing.
There you go, Danny boy.
Now you're really in the shit though, aren't you? Back home with the kids, finding the cat, cutting the grass. Rather you than me, mate. Dan tried to laugh, but it turned into a raspy cough. I pulled his thumb out of the entry wound. The pressure released and blood gushed out again. I replaced his hand with mine now and held the other bottle up in my left hand for the fluid to run down the tube as the medics dropped to their knees beside us. They removed my hand from his chest, and as they did so, air escaped once more. Bradley's US infantry fighting vehicles were swarming into the area. I watched as the medics put an oxygen mask over Dan's face and stuck tubes into him. They sorted out Kenny, while others jumped into the warrior and checked the bed. I sat in the rubble looking down at Dan. He turned his blood-stained face towards me and gave me the middle finger, along with a smile. I gave him the finger back. No way you're going to score now, is there? Where are those chocolates? I might still make the party.
You've been listening to Spoken from the Front with me, Andy McNabb.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.